Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name's David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature in 3 days, 5 months, 28 years, and for this I am so thankful. First of all, I want to thank the committee for inviting this member of Alcoholics Anonymous to be here this weekend and allow this alcoholic the freedom to share this alcoholic with you and the freedom for you to share this yourselves with this alcoholic. And I'll tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's one of the finest service meetings on an area level that I have attended in a long, long time. And I've been going to them for almost 28 years. At least 15, 20 or more a year. And I'll tell you, it was something else. And I heard perhaps the finest description of the role of a GSR that I have ever heard in my life, including a voting member of 6 conferences that are a general service conference. And contrary to rumor, I know I was not stranded at the airport. I have been in contact by phone all hours of the day and night with Roy. And I told him that if he didn't know what I looked like, to just sit there and get a card and put David A. on it. And when I got off the airplane, there he was in the card, with a card. And I zeroed him in, and here we are. You know, I was read a while ago that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. Well, it was on the last Sunday in August of 1950, which last month was 45 years ago, that a group of fine and sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an open AA meeting at the Suburban Group in Dallas, Texas. The Wednesday before that Sunday, I stumbled into one of Dallas's more affluent barbershops, and I fell in this chair at this manicurist table. Now, I was more at myself that morning. Now, being more at myself in those days meant that I was drinking. I wasn't too drunk. I could sit in a chair for about 10 minutes without falling out of it. I could navigate to and from the men's room, go out and get me another bottle of whiskey. And I looked at this gal. This old gal looked at me, the ugliest looking gal. She's a manicurist by name either. And she looked at me and she said, "David," and right there and then I should have known she didn't call me doctor. I said, "David, I belong to a group called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink of alcohol in a year." And I looked at Edith and I said, "You are a liar. Nobody stays sober a year. Maybe a day, 2 days, three, not more than a year. No, I haven't had a drink in a year." Now, Edith looked like a drunk ought to look like, you know, sort of a female-looking Roy over here. You know. Her face wasn't real pretty. It looked like a truck had run over it and then backed over if she had done a good job. She had big bug eyes and gaps in her teeth, and God bless her, her nose had been broken and sort of leaned on the left side of her face. Now, this is back in the days before the gals used to wear pantyhose and used to wear garter belts. Pull her drawers down, hold her socks up. And when she was drinking, hers always trailed behind her uniform. She'd trip and drop and fall those manicuring bottles. And back in those days, the ladies used to wear hose with the seams up the back. You could always tell when Edith was drunk. The seams in the front was in the back. But God, she's a great gal. The best way I can describe Edith looks as a drunk in our part of the country, and I may be here, I don't know about Utah. If your car happens to be caught out in a hailstorm and is pretty badly beaten up right when you get your insurance checked, if you have insurance, some wise brother said, "I don't get it fixed. Let it sit out in the hot sun for about 3 or 4 weeks, and all the dents will pop back out." Her dents never pop back out. God, she's a great gal. But when Edith told me she hadn't had a drink of alcohol in a year, that got my attention. Because when Edith was drinking, she had the reputation of being an incorrigible, mean, nasty, fighting woman drunk. She could outdrink any fight, any man, anywhere, on the moon, under the moon, around the moon. She carried a big black purse. She always had 2 pints of whiskey in that purse. She'd kill you if you got in that purse. And there she was. She said she hadn't had a drink in a year. And I got to watching her. And I noticed she changed. I noticed when she was giving me my manicure that morning, she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles and my ears and my shoulders. I looked up at her face, and it was amazing. Her lipstick was on her lips and not her eyebrows. I sniffed her, and she didn't smell halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. She didn't grab her purse and say, "Now, I'll be back in 10 minutes and maybe show up 11 months later." It was amazing. But I noticed the real change, and the change was in her eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have two kinds of eyes. We have those sad, sad, sick eyes. And then we have those happy, dancing, laughing, sparkling, living, sober eyes. Oh, yes, we got another kind of eyes, those glassy eyes. They'll get up behind one of these things, say, "I haven't had a drink of alcohol, you know," and then fall over. But her eyes were sparkling and they were jumping, and she looked like she was having a lot of fun living sober. And then she turns a manicurist in the same shop by the name of Moena. And she said, "Moena, here is my sponsor." And she had 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, back in those days in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, any time we mentioned or talked about our sponsors, it was with reverence. Because we respected our sponsors. We respect our sponsors. Because we literally turned our lives over to the care for their experience and not their opinion. Because we find as a result of our experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker. And in some instances to physically kill people. There is no one in Alcoholics Anonymous has the sole right to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. No one's been so designated. We have no right to play with anyone's emotions or anyone's head or anything else. We only got one story to tell. What it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. And you know, since April the 26th, I haven't found it necessary to leave Alcoholics Anonymous to find an easier way to live sober, a more sociably acceptable way to live sober. A more fun way to live sober, nor a more exciting way to live sober. Thank God I haven't had to go to one of them action-reaction courses, concentration movement, related disorders institute. When I got to you people, my wife was a related disorder. Hanging there till your drawers fall off, baby. Sexual dysfunction seminars. I'll tell you. If you get as old as I am and been able to stay sober as long as I have, only by the grace, today I do not need a sexual dysfunction seminar. I need a memory course. Now, you hear a lot of things in AA today, you know, that I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, dog, cat, snake, kangaroo, minor bird, zebra, glue bottle. I'll let you know right up front. I'm an adult spouse of an Al-Anon. And when Moena, and I looked at Moena when he said Moena had 15 months. I looked at Moena and I said, "Moena, you're a bigger liar than Goofy over here." I said, "Moena, we had a drink night." She said, "No, David, I have not had a drink of alcohol with you or anyone else or myself in 15 continuous months." Pardon me. Eve has not had a drink of alcohol in 12 continuous months. Little did I realize that those precious words that fine lady said to me that morning would stick with me for many, many years. She talked about continuous sobriety. At that time, I had no reason whatsoever to know that it was one day at a time. Then she said, "David, we have an open meeting this Sunday at 5:30 in the afternoon. And it's open so that the public can come in and hear and see how an alcoholic recovers in the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to find how an AA lives the AA way of life, and more important for you who are not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, what AA is and what AA is not. And believe it or not, the greatest challenge that we have in the world right now, all over the world this second, that there are hundreds of thousands of our members who do not know what Alcoholics Anonymous is not, that we're not all things for all people. The singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is what made Alcoholics Anonymous the most precious and finest recovery program and fellowship that the world has seen, is seen, and probably ever will see. And she said, only members of AA will participate in the meeting. And then because it is the last Sunday of the month, they have a sort of little birthday anniversary party for those who have one or more years of continuous sobriety. And we would like for you and your wife to come. And I thought that, well, the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA meetings and stay to one of your AA functions is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you lepers in the community. And I'm glad to come help you. So I went home and told my wife, Grace, and God, she was thrilled, because people had long since quit asking us to come around. Grace, you said to me, why isn't it we're not asked to the outdoor barbecue, square dances, round dances, nightclub supper parties, swimming pool parties, card parties? I said, it's you. It's you. Every time we're asked to go out on Saturday night, you start on me on the Monday before, and you start screaming, you're not going to drink. You're not going to get drunk, are you? Wake me up out of a sound sleep 5:30 the next morning screaming, did you hear what I said? And you keep it up Tuesday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, Wednesday night, Thursday, Thursday night, Friday, Friday night. And what a tremendous price society's had to pay, is paying, I guess will always pay. Those who love us, those who hate us, those who do not even care that we exist on this earth. What a tremendous price those people are paying to find out that the more you scream at us about our drinking, the more we're going to drink. I said, and furthermore, woman, when we get to where we're supposed to get to, for finding any part of the car, you out of the car, you run in, you grab the host and the hostess, you chase them out of the kitchen, through the den, in the backyard, in the alley, in the bushes, in the garbage, in the neighborhood, screaming, don't you give him a drink of alcohol. Woman, you're sick, that's what's wrong with you. But through tear-filled eyes, she said, we're going to the meeting, and I said, yes. And so that Sunday morning, I got up at 5:30 in the morning to get ready to go to an AA meeting 5:30 that afternoon. Well, now, what does a good, self-respectful drinking drunk do when he gets up 5:30 on Sunday morning? Drinks alcohol, that's what he does. Let's face it, very simple. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, drunks drink. There's no big mystery. I started sucking on a new bottle of juice. You know, take that first drink, God, that gets you breathing started. Then that second drink regulates your breathing. Then that third drink goes down to both heels and just sets you there. Now you're ready to do some real drinking, aren't you? And I'm drinking and I'm looking up at the birds, the bees, and the trees. And I'm hearing the neighbors screaming, Johnny, get dressed, we'll be late for church. And I said, oh, those sick people, they do not know what living really is. If they could just learn how to control it and enjoy it like I was doing, they would find out that right after breathing in and out, alcohol is the second greatest gift God's given mankind. Amen. Took another drink. Drank half that fifth of whiskey and put the other half the fifth in the trunk of my car because I knew at that time that I was going to be required to have another drink of alcohol, not knowing the exact reason until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of these that firmly believe that if and when our kind comes to us, until we are able to hear the message and find out what's wrong with us, we'll never be able to find out what can get right with us. And I went in and I bathed and I shaved, put on everything rich and nice looking to impress those poor, sick people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Put on a beautiful, brand new, tailor-made suit, white-on-white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram tie, monogram drawers, put on my diamond ring, my diamond watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respectful, high-rolling, drinking drunk. Brand new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. I look just like a used car salesman. Or a dope dealer. And at 10:30 in the morning, I'm at my long Roadmaster Buick honking my horn. And out comes my wife with the rollers in her hair, And she has on It's at All Your Fault kimono that they just live in and dying and crying. Well, she lost a string about in the middle and pinned together with a big baby diaper pin. And she's pulled all the threading and the padding and the fuzzing and the buttons off the front. And the front's just covered with tear stains and cigarette burns. It's what us drunks and Alcoholics Anonymous lovingly call the Al-Anon designer house coat. And in a beautiful, wifely tone of voice, she screams out like a wild banshee. What do you want, you no good, sorry drunk? Meanwhile, all the neighbors had gathered out. And her side's lined up over here, and my side is lined up over here. And I'm still here to find ladies of the neighborhood saying, isn't it a shame that such a beautiful and fine lady and the mother of two beautiful little boys married to such a sorry, no good drunk like him? And my bunch over here hollering out, let her have it, David, let her have it. And that used to be the weekend entertainment in every neighborhood we lived in. We moved 24 times before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes at midnight, high noon, daybreak. Sometimes ahead of the sheriff, a few times with the sheriff, behind the sheriff, just kept moving. I said, let's go to the meeting. She said, doesn't get started for 7 more hours, you no good drunk. And with that, she turned on the heels and went back in the house. Well, that started 7 tough hours here this Sunday. And I'm sucking on the only bottle of juice that I have. No, I was going to have to be a drink. Because when I drank, I rolled it all the way. And one of the biggest problems I had before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, with the exception of the last 14 months of my drinking, is they'd pull me off my drunks and I wasn't through drinking. I'd come in and I'd cry. And I'd pledge. And I'd get on my knees and I'd pray. And I put my hand in the Bible, on the Bible, around the Bible, underneath the cat's belly, stroke the dog's tail. I'll never do it again. And I wait till they tuck some more money or a check in my shirt pocket. And as soon as they turn their backs, I'd run off to finish the drunk. Now, I was a stay away from home kind of drunk, not on purpose. I'd get drunk, and I ended up in countries I never knew existed on this earth. I ended up with people I never saw before in my life. Sometimes with clothes on, sometimes the other way, sometimes with money, sometimes without. They tell me I've gone 11 months. No one knew where I was. My mother, my father, my wife, our two sons, my patients, my enemies, friends, no one knew where I was. And I come running in the house with the same clothes I guess I'd had on for about 5 months. And I asked my wife this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And that doesn't make for good marriage relationships, I'll tell you. And I knew that if I called a bootlegger, I'd blow the deal. Because, you see, when I got out of the service the first time in 1947, the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas tried to net me. They tried to net me in 48. They tried to net me in 49. They tried to net me in January of 50. And they thought to set the trap on the last Sunday of August of 1950. So I found just enough to nurse me along, keep the edge going. And finally, we went to the meeting. And we drove up, and there must have been about 50 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, or 40, or whatever it was. And it looked like to me and some kids and a poodle or two jumping up and down. And God, it looked like to me in those days everybody smoked. They were all hugging and kissing and rubbing up against and scratching and laughing and smoking. And I stepped back and I looked at those idiots. And I said, by gosh, if they're alcoholics and they're having that much fun, they're not drinking alcohol, then they have to be on dope. And then I looked up and I saw that sign, but for the grace of God, my head ducked. Because I knew at that time that I was not living according to the dictates of God's will for a human being. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that if and when our kind comes to us, even though many of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous without a full string of lights in our head, that deep down inside, every one of us know this. If there is a principle we never hear discussed in AA on any level, if very, very rarely, that every one of us are born human beings first. And when we're born human beings and given the most precious gift that a human being will ever receive, and that's the gift of life, and we begin to breathe in and out right there and then, is the creation, the formation, and the development of selfishness and self-centeredness. And from that selfishness and self-centeredness stems all those defects of character that we refuse to recognize, those defects that made our lives unmanageable, those moral defects, resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear, and not want to tell another human being how darn phony we are or what's really churning down with the inside of us. We get so carried away with this alcoholic syndrome or whatever that is, and everything about, you know, about this business. AA ain't interested when you get it, jackass. It's what you want to do out about it when you get here. That's all alcoholics not to worry about and concerned about. That's all it is. But we get so carried away. What amazes me is when I cross the invisible line. Well, how do you know when you cross the invisible line if it's invisible? The problem drinker has been crossing it from that time he became a problem drinker, whenever it was. And A's not interested when you become a problem drinker. It's what you when you become an ex-problem drinker. That's all that we're interested in, period. And I didn't know this, and I had many, many years to go. Because, you see, Alcoholics Anonymous does something that formalized, organized religion never has and probably never will have the success that AA has. Medicine has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Psychiatry has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Government agencies has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Human willpower has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Treatment modalities has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Acupuncture has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Hypnosis has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Biorhythm charts has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Horoscopes has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Witch doctors has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reaches down the innermost depths of a human being. This most precious thing that comes with each and every one of us at birth, God-given. This precious thing that after we get comfortable with our own selves, after being forced here by the agent that forces us to come, that fine, precious voice that says, thank you, little alcoholic, for not taking a drink of alcohol today. Thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a way to have a reasonably good night's sleep. But more important, thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a group of people who love you no matter what you have done, what you are doing, or what you ever will do. That is where the great power of our society lies. One drunk talking to another. And I had many years to go before I read. They blew a whistle, they hollered, and I went in on the meeting, and I went and I sat on the back row because I wanted to see what kind of help that bunch of sick people that I could afford to give them. The first talker got up, and it was a woman. The lyingest, cheatingest person I'd ever been around in my life. I thought she'd been dead years ago. And there she stood, and she said she was sober, sane, in a right mind, and hadn't had a drink of alcohol in a year. And I jumped up and I screamed out, you are a liar. And somebody said, shut up. You know how a wet drunk answers you when you tell them to shut up? Make me. Well, they had enough in that room to make me. And she's got to talking about her Jesus and her trip to the Holy Land and the Pope and everything. And I said, by gosh. What a heck of a trick to pull on a guy like me. You brought me there to convert me. And if this is what you were, I needed to drink real bad. But you see, I violated a very serious code in my living and my drinking. Because you see, I started drinking with and working with and fighting with and cheating with the black and white wino, which was then Skid Row. It's Skid Row today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row in Dallas, Texas. And I've lived on 3 Skid Rows in my lifetime. One for over 6 years, one for over 4 years, but the last one for 14 months was the toughest. And I'm not going to stand up here tonight and share life on Skid Row with you, but the Skid Rows that I lived on, there was no day and there was no night. There was no sun and there was no moon and there were no stars and there were no clouds. There were no seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, just total inner and outer blackness and darkness. And the best way I can describe that kind of an existence is just bodies and feet. And you don't care if you live, you don't care if you die, you don't care if you work, you don't care if you don't work, you don't care if you sleep, you don't care if you stay awake, you don't care if you see your loved ones, you don't care if you see them, you just don't care. Now, an alcoholic cannot stay on Skid Row. I'll tell you that right now. An alcoholic's got to get off of Skid Row because an alcoholic will lie about that alcoholic drinking. That alcoholic will hide that alcoholic bottle. And I'll tell you right now, if you hide your bottle on the road and you don't share it, you're not long for this earth. I don't mind telling you that. And I did not have to be down there. I came from one of the finest families that God ever put on this earth. A mother and father who dedicated their two lives to give to the two sons that were born to that marriage, and I being the oldest, everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one of the sons is going to become an alcoholic and you've got a parent that's willing to go to any length and every length to keep him from hurting and to suffering and to keep him from bringing shame and disgrace on the family name and the family heritage and the family religion, that's paradise for an alcoholic. And after I got sober and everything, I wrote my four-step inventory because I hated and resented my mother and father because of the manner in which they treated me as opposite to my brother. And after I looked at my inventory, because 14 and a half years before I got sober, the religion that my mother and father were born in, lived in, died in, very devout. They lit the candles of the dead and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days. And on the 8th day, they said the final prayer of death and blew out the flame in the candle. And as far as they were concerned, in their minds, they no longer had an older son that was alive on this earth. And that was the greatest thing in the world they could have done for them about me. No longer could I go to them and beg and bind and cry and beg me out. That was total release. And when I wrote my inventory and realized that up until the time my mother and father prayed me dead, for me, not you, they were the worst parents that I ever could have possibly had because they never allowed me to fall. They broke every fall. And until I had to start picking David up, David was never going to find a way to get well. And that's what I was doing. I was going through life, chipping away people that were trying to help me, absolutely trying to help me. I started out on Skid Row at 10 and a half years of age. Started drinking bay rum and wine. That was the standard fare. And later on, as I grew older, physically, and get more money in my pocket, I'd go from that bay rum and that wine to that good stuff and never miss a lick. And I don't know about you. I wasn't drinking it down there because of the smell of it. I wasn't drinking it because it was socially acceptable. I wasn't drinking it because it was popular. I was drinking it because I liked what it did to me and with me and for me when it got in and down and through me. And I liked what it allowed me to do to you or against you when it got in and down and through me. And little did I realize that the first drink of alcohol I took, it affected David's head. And David said to David, David, every chance you're going to get, you're going to take a drink of alcohol to reproduce that initial effect. And little did I realize that right there and then, it was the beginning of a problem. I learned a lot of other things down on Skid Row. Never get your back up against the wall. Didn't have a back door window you could jump out of. If you smoke or anything, keep both hands free so you can hit and run. I've always been 5'6". I was born 5'6". I'd drink that juice and I'd be 7 foot tall. I've had hundreds of fights. Never won a one. My nose has been where my navel is. My nails have been where right. I've been all rearranged. When I was 14, 15, 16, 17 years of age, I run off and joined Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus. Now, back in those days, the Ringling Show was the finest under canvas in the entire world. And it would have been a thrill for a youngster to go with the Ringling in those days, with all the wild animals and the clowns. And I was with him when Tom Mix and his trick horse, Tony, they started the Wild West Show. I was with him when Gargantua, the gorilla, come aboard. You've got to be not only an extremely drunk, but nuts to try to climb in that cage with that gorilla and try to make love and friends with that gorilla. I'll tell you that right now. And I drank with the most delightful drunks I ever drank in my life.
It's the only bunch of drunks that I was taller than. I drank with all the midgets. And let me tell you about it. The midgets and myself, we used to drink the most beautiful concoctions ever been devised by man, called Green Lizard Circus Style. A tremendous drink. Elixir of sodium bromide and Lucky Tiger hair tonic. Now, I'll tell you, we'd drink that stuff, and we'd see Bambi and those animals in Technicolor long before Walt Disney ever put them on screen. And those midgets are something else. First of all, when they get, they're tremendous athletes. And when they get drunk, they get just meaner than mean. And they slide under your legs, and nobody can catch them. They climb poles. They terrorize the elephants, everything in this God's world. They drove the fat lady in the circus absolutely insane. And one day John Ringling North called me before him. He said, "Boy, you're going to have to leave the circus." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you're ruining my midgets." I said, "Ruining your midgets? They're ruining me." And I went back and I told the midgets. The midgets went to see him. They said, "If he leaves, we leave. And you can't have a good circus without midgets and clowns and wild animals." But you see, I'm trying to live three codes of living. I'm trying to live the code of living society was demanding that I live. To go to school, become a useful human being. And be of service to my God and my country and my fellow man. And not end up in goonie roosts and in jails and sleeping on steam grates and in cardboard boxes and alleys and bushes and garbage. And I'm trying to live the code of living my mother and father wanted me to live, and they had all the money. And if you had already been in all the trouble I had been in, was in, and get ready to get into, it takes a lot of money to get you out so you can get back in it again. And then I'm trying to live the code of living that alcohol was demanding all my life, and you're way ahead of me. You know when which one went out. My mother and father would find me. They'd send private. They'd send everybody after me. I'd come home. I'd be back in school. But my body was in the classroom, but my mind was out there. Because I had experienced some things youngsters my age never would experience. Being around an environment to where life meant nothing on Skid Row wasn't nothing. Somebody just walk off. They just didn't like the way your shoes were. They just cut your head off, you know. And being the only one, being a youngster down there, I was their pet. You know, there's 11 blacks in me. I'm the only one that's alive. Every one of them ended in the most horrible active alcoholic death that one could imagine. Fire. Just absolutely horrible. And I'm the only one that's alive. And I'm so thankful. But God, they were good to me. They were good to me. But the reason that I wanted back out there is not what I experienced. I had to get sober and alcoholic enough to realize that I wasn't through drinking. And until I was through drinking, I wasn't through drinking. Someone asked me not long ago, "David, will you describe it?" I said, "Yep. I was drinking because I was drinking, and I couldn't stop drinking because I couldn't stop drinking." Now, that's not very scientific. And you don't have to pay $28,000 to stay there 30 days to find that out. Yeah, that's it. That's it. We all went through that. But I had many years to go before I realized this. And here I am. You see what I tell this story? Because here I am on the back row. There's no back window and there's nowhere to jump to leave. And that woman talking about Christ and good God Almighty, and I'm wanting to drink bad. But I had to get sober and alcoholics and on to find out that it wasn't what that woman talked about of Jesus and about the Lord's Prayer and that all that they mentioned God in that meeting. No. Remember, I told you I got up at 5:30 in the morning and started drinking. I also told you that I knew I was going to have me a drink. I found out the reason that I had to have a drink after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found it out in the doctor's opinion. That tremendous craving for alcohol. Little did I realize that I was suffering from a twofold illness of mind and body. A mental obsession so powerful that it was condemning me to drink against my own will. And the physical nature of the illness was condemning me to die if I continued to drink. And once I drank,
It set up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. My God, how my body craved alcohol when I was drinking. And I'm on this back row, and I'm miserable. And I'm wanting to drink so bad, and every time I stood up to walk through those 80 people to go out to the trunk of my car to get that half-fifth in the trunk, it looked like 80 people turned around, pointed fingers at me, and said, "Shut up and sit here and listen, and this is for you." Because they could see in me what I couldn't see in myself. But I couldn't see it. And I hated every member of Alcoholics Anonymous in that meeting and the horse and wagons that brought them all across country. And as soon as that meeting was over with, I ran through those 80 folks like a tornado. And I got out the trunk of my car and I got that half-fifth whiskey out. I don't know about anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous this meeting. I drank that half-fifth down in two swallows. That's the way I drank alcohol. I never put alcohol in a brandy glass and run around sniff it for 4 or 5 hours and burn candles and incense and listen to Lawrence Welk. And I never put an inch of whiskey in a glass, 12 ice cubes, 9.5 inches of soda water, a straw and fruit and a cherry and a half a Christmas tree on top of it and suck on it for about 3 hours. To me, that's sick drinking. I drank it a dropper down that hole where it'll do the most good and put nothing. Let me tell you what happened when I got down. My hair laid back now. My toes went back in those alligator shoes. I ran up the steps, got a hold of the oldest sober member, and my underwear loosened up. I ran in there, got a hold of the oldest sober member of the group, and got to arguing with you about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I hit it. Now, when I was drinking, I was bad to hit folks. Taller than me, shorter than me, fatter than me, skinnier than me. And two of his AA babies joined in, we started to fight. And I'll tell you right now, that fight was a lot better than that AA meeting. And I was just whipping the dickens out of them two little sober wimps. And then they did an unfair thing. They ran in two more drunks about the size of the outside linebackers on any professional football team. And finally, four of them picked me up bodily, two on each side, went to the front door of that group, kicked the door open, and threw me right out of that group. As I'm flying through the air, one of them said, "We do not need your kind here." And another one said, "And furthermore, you are too young to be an alcoholic." And God, was I glad to hear that. And I stood on that grass that Sunday evening, drunk and belligerent, with my fist clenched, screaming and hollering and cursing to anybody listening to me. I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving organization as long as I live. That I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. But the next 17 years, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being. And the only three things never did happen to me: getting ready to get on a drunk, coming off a drunk right to this very second, as I never did willfully murder another human being, fall in love with another man, or die drunk. Other than that, it all happened. Of course, I guess blackouts don't count. I really don't know. Well, we don't want anybody leaving an AA meeting with resentment, you know. Well, I'd married this wonderful gal. And when we got married, she didn't realize that she was married an active alcoholic. So we didn't start to build a marriage, started to build a booby trap. One that could go off any, you know, week, month, or year. And I'd been in the service already the first time, you know, and here I'm out, and this is when they nailed me. And the first time I was in the service, it wasn't too bad. I went in as a naval dental officer, and I had what to call.
Fell off to New Jersey twice. Once in dry dock in Bremerton, and later on off Incheon. And I was recalled back into the service as a naval dental officer, and I went with a combat marine division. I got into more trouble than there's trouble. Christmas Day, 1954, I'm laying in a maximum prison. And I got a leg iron locked around my right leg and a chain weld in the leg iron, other than chain weld steel cot, full leg steel cot, immersed concrete, and the armed guerrillas around me daring me to move 24 hours a day. And the word was, when you arrived there, you never would leave. And I saw how some of them left. Dead from the top of their head down to their toes. And I didn't find out how I got there after I got there. And I've been laying like that for 6 months. And I'm hating society. You know, resentment can carry you a long way, but it'll warp your mind. And it is Christmas Day, 54. And I'm hating everything and everybody. And I'll tell you right now, when you're thousands of miles away from your mama and your papa, you talk about lonesomeness, and you talk about loneliness, and you talk about the four horsemen of despair, and you talk about inner and outer blackness and darkness, and here is where you hear grown men scream, Mama, Mama, help me, help me. And I'll tell you right now, and I'm hating society, and in comes, now in this place, there was no knives and forks or spoons. I've been lying. And they come in, and they give you once a day, they fed you. And he held the cup while you lapped it up like a dough. They didn't dare give you the cup. Now, the everyday fare, it was like dishwater. Once a day. But Christmas is a special day. Dishwater, but it had one a noodle in it. And you dream, you know, that there's rice, and there's chicken, and there's carrots, and there's celery, and mama's homemade barley soup, you know. And here comes this orderly in with this Christmas dinner. And he says, ho, 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 Merry Christmas. And I'm so full of Christmas spirit and joy for my fellow man, I says, ho, 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 you know what? He said, here's your Christmas dinner. You no good, sorry, son of a gun. You're not going to leave here anyway. And when he made one mistake, as he started to pour it down my lip, I got it away from him. And I hit him right in the face with that bolt. And my Christmas gift for doing that Christmas day was 75 more straight days on nothing. Now, that's what you call a bad day. I have not had a day that bad since I have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And neither have you. I got out of that. Talked my wife into taking me back. We started moving around again. We decided to move to the panhandle of West Texas and raise our two little boys in a Christian environment. I don't know how many of y'all ever lived in a little town about 3,500 people that live in a Christian environment. That's a town that votes dry and drinks wet. Mary, if you lived in Oklahoma, you know exactly what I'm talking about. They vote dry. And the two most popular people in the town is the undertaker and the bootlegger. And I was drinking to where I got up to where I weighed 245 pounds, and my blood pressure was so high that every time my pulse would beat, my hair would stand straight up and pump like an oil well. Had a fat doctor friend live in the next town I go see. He looks at me and says, my God, David, you look sick. Puts a cuff around my arm, runs the air up, starts letting it down. He says, my God, David, it's a miracle you're alive. Your blood pressure's so high. Then he says, your blood pressure's so high because you're so fat. Then he says, the reason you're so fat because you eat so much, which was not true. I was bloated. And he said, you do not have any guts or willpower, and I'm going to have to give you some help. And he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules I've ever seen in my life called Nemudons. He said, take them as directed. I said, doctor, is it all right if I drink a couple of beers while I take this medication? He says, I don't believe it'll hurt you. He never should have told me that. So I went home and I looked at the prescriptions, take one of them beauties three times a day after meals. Well, who eats when you drink? And every good, self-respectful drinking drunk knows if one's good, two's better, three's terrific. So I took three of them, drank some whiskey. Didn't feel like I was losing any weight. Come back out and took three more of them. Drank some more alcohol. Went in the bathroom, turned sideways, looked in the mirror. Didn't look like I was losing any weight. Come back out and took a handful of them. Drank some more whiskey. Looked like my stomach's getting bigger. Finally, I took all the pills and drank all the whiskey.
And the next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard, and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. I don't mind telling you. And they tell me I ran around that little town for 2 days talking in the unknown tongue. And being one of two Jewish families in five counties around, they gathered everybody in to see and hear the miracle. Because word had spread like wildfire. The Jew had caught the Holy Ghost. And when I come to and realize what happened, I said, my God, those pills are messing up my drinking. I'd been to psychiatrist. All the questions he asked me for nothing. And I promised Roy I'd tell this story. I don't tell it too often. But it was in this little town that the true picture of how active alcoholism not only affects the problem drinker, but the people who we love and who love us the most. The richest man in the town died. And he loved me dearly. Because he had an active alcoholic daughter that they had to put her barefooted on a bus with a one-way ticket from the panhandle of West Texas to Vancouver. And he died, and the family asked me to be a pallbearer. You know, that's an honor to be a pallbearer. And it was one of them cold, rainy days in the panhandle of West Texas, not quite cold enough to sleep, and I'm home getting all juiced up and dressed to be a pallbearer. Every button on my shirt, I button, I take a drink. Put on my right boot, take a drink. Left boot, take a drink. Put on my tie, take a drink. Put my coat on, take a drink. Drank half of that fifth, put the other half of the fifth under the front seat of that old station wagon, and off I go to church house. I don't know how many of y'all live in a small country town. They didn't dig, they don't dig a basement. The basement's the ground floor. They just did build the church over in the basement. And he's in this church, and it's like old-fashioned church, and it's like climbing steps, like climbing up Pike's Peak. And to get down on the front row, hopeless row, them old curved two pews, is like skiing down Pike's Peak. And I'm down there, and my God, the place is hot. And all I'm thinking about taking a drink of alcohol, that's all, and that's not sanity. And the host minister opens up the services, and all I'm thinking about is taking a drink. And I knew all the eulogizers. And as soon as the last eulogizer got through, I was going to take me a drink of whiskey. Well, the last eulogizer got, and I was trying to sneak out of there, but they had augmented the choir, and the choir had to sing. And the choir started singing, and I believe they sang every hymn in the Methodist hymnal and half out of the Baptist hymnal, you know. Wandering child, I know I'm in Mormon country. Wandering child, please come home. We'll all gather down by the river at the foot of the cross. And Jesus loves you. And Amazing Grace. And I hate that hymn. Because I'm married to a gal and her name is Grace. And she ain't amazing. I don't mind that. Finally, they get through singing. And you know what the pallbearers got to do? You got to wheel the deceased up the hill. While the congregation files by. And then the congregation files down the steps leading to the hearse. And I knew I could never hold the northeast corner of that coffin up without a drink of alcohol. And as soon as one of the funeral house assistants came by, I nailed him. I said, take my place. And I scooted out the side door, and I got in that old station wagon. And I drove about 2 blocks from that church, and I reached under there and peeled that bottle of that sack down like a banana. And I took me a drink, and oh, my God, I began to feel better and loosen up, you know, and took another one and another one and another one. And thank God I had sanity enough at that time not to try to crawl in with the pallbearers drunk. Or try to drive in a funeral procession 10 miles an hour drunk and drinking. So I said, well, I'll meet him out at the cemetery. The cemetery's 5 miles out of town. So I'll gauge my speed, and I'll be out there, and I'll meet him. So here I'm driving. I'm drinking with one hand, and I turn on my car radio, and I love country western music more than anything else in this God's world. And my favorite radio station in those days was Del Rio, Texas, where they sold Bibles and crosses and rejuvenation powders and potions and lotions. They sold everything, and they played the finest of country western tunes, you know. Don't wink them bloodshot eyes at me. And here's one that's good for 11 months of drinking and 14 months of crying. Only God made honky-tonk angels, you know.
And they sold everything under the sun over there. Get your Cupid doll of Jesus. You can love him. You can hug him. You can kiss him. He's with you 365 days out of the year. And he glows in the dark, you know. And I'm singing. I'm singing. And I'm listening. I get out to the graveyard. I'm the only one there. Take a couple of honks on that juice and crawl up that wet hill. The false grass had been laid. Chairs over it. Tent over it. The grave had been dug, stanchions at each end, and a sling for the coffin. Being a good, smart, nosy drunk, I got to see that all the arrangements are proper. See a couple of chairs out of line, straighten them, get behind the lectern, make about a 3-minute eulogy. Nobody shows up. So I slide down the hill, take about 8 more honks of lime juice. And by this time, I'm not only drunk, I'm good and drunk, and I'm not seeing double, I'm seeing quadruple. And I'm coming up the hill, and I see 4 rows of chairs that are out of line. And if there's one thing our kind don't want, we don't want anybody to know we've been around and messed up. I've got to straighten those chairs. So I'm aiming for 4 rows that ain't out of line. And I don't know if you've been unsteady or balanced and drunk, and one of my toes hit that false grass, and when it gets wet, it's like that indoor-outdoor carpet, just slick as you know what. And I started sliding, and the next thing you knew, I grabbed 2 chairs. And the next thing you know, me and 2 chairs, we're down the bottom of that hole down there. And I'm telling you right now, when you're extremely drunk and you're flat on your back and you can't get up, it is the most helpless feeling in the world. And here comes the host minister. And here comes my wife. And here comes the pallbearers with the deceased. And the son of the deceased hears all that scratching and squealing down at the bottom of that hole. And he sticks his long turkey neck down there and he sees me and he asks me this brilliant question, "What are you doing down there?" And I give him a drunk's best shot. I said, "I'm trying to get out. That's what I'm doing." And they haul me out and I'm muddy and I'm wet and ever eyes looking at me while they finish the final rites of that wonderful man. Now, if that should happen to a social drinker, chances are they'll stop drinking the rest of their life. They're so embarrassed. They're so ashamed. But no, I'm an alcoholic. Here comes the difference with our kind. I could see the looks of astonishment, embarrassment, disgrace, shame, tears, befuddlement, utter disbelief in the eyes of the people who I love the most, who love me the most. And yet I saw the looks in those eyes, although those eyes do not audibly speak these words. Every alcoholic has seen it in the eyes of those who we love and who love us the most. And unfortunately, sometimes after we get into AA, and that look doesn't say these words, but it looks these looks, "Oh no, not again." And I said to myself, get these services over with so I can obliterate from my uppermost consciousness the looks in the eyes of the people who love me the most and I love the most. And when the services were over, one of the most difficult things in the world as far as the blood kinning emotionally to realize that we drank in many instances the way we did because we loved our loved ones so much. We couldn't stand what was happening to us, and we knew that if we drank, it would obliterate that innermost thinking and that innermost fear and that innermost pain. Because, see, when you've got an illness that you don't want and you can't get rid of it, how can it be moral? And you can't cure it. No. But we can arrest it, thank God. I didn't know this. When those services were over with, I left that town. I got a box of alcohol. And I didn't come back to that town for 3.5 months. But the ridicule and the shame that my wife and our 2 sons had to endure was almost too much for their sanity. We had to move away from that town. We moved back to Dallas and start with a wonderful opportunity. But it wasn't long before I was back on that last skid row emptying wine bottles. You see, I was condemned to do what I was doing as long as I was doing. I had no defense against that drink.
I went home once the last 11 months I drank. I walked in, Grace looked at me, and she says, "Do you have to drink and do the things that you do?" I says, "Grace, why don't you find another man that'll marry you? You're such a fine lady. That'll not only be a good husband to you, but a fine father to those two fine sons. I cannot function as a son. I cannot function as a father. I cannot function as a husband. I cannot function as a professional man. I have no desire to live. I can't stay sober. I'm going to die drunk." You see, if you read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had that seemingly state of hopelessness and helplessness of mind. Seemingly hopeless and helpless. But it was real to me. And I turned my back and I went out and tried to proceed to kill myself. I found the handwriting on the floor of the county jail in Dallas, Texas, somewhere between April the 18th, 1920, really don't know. By this time, I run out of everything and everybody. And I got down to me, and me couldn't stay sober, and me couldn't stay drunk, and me couldn't kill myself, and me couldn't stay alive. And me didn't want me as me was, but me's gone, me every place me went. I didn't holler, I didn't scream, I didn't plead, I didn't put any conditions on it. I just simply said that deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is this fundamental idea of God. I just simply said, "God, help me." And the minute I did that, without any conditions whatsoever, got me out of me. Something deep from within me kept saying, "Continue sobriety. Alcoholics Anonymous, continue sobriety. Alcoholics Anonymous." Them gals stuck that needle deep in me. And I said, if I ever get out of this jail, I've got to find those folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. And how I got by that old sheriff, I don't know. That's a story in itself. Now, I've been in lots of jails, and being in jail is not a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got out, I found a gal, Edith, who asked me to come to that first year birthday party and meeting. She passed away. She was continuously sober when she passed away. Her sponsor, Moena, had moved to West Texas. After I was sober 9 months, Moena moved back to Dallas. She became secretary of our AA group. She went back to manicuring. I used to see Moena every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock as my manicurist. And in March of 1986, Moena passed away. And if she'd lived two more months, she would have been 37 continuous sober years in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a man at that meeting, the only one I can remember. He was sober 8 years. He went back to drinking. He drank for 8 years. In December of the year ago, he passed away, and he was 28 years sober that stretch. I called him up. He wanted to know, "Who is it for?" And I said, "It's for me." He said, "Well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with, and don't take a drink of alcohol, and call me at 7:30 the next morning." Boom, and that's it. And he hung up. That's all he told me. And after giving it 37 and a half years, the best shot, it was cold turkey. Well, it's more like frozen buzzard, if you want to know the truth of the matter. I started walking and shaking out of drunk. And the next morning I come to, and I was sober. And thank God I didn't have a belly full of tranquilizers nor a prescription for 400 more. 7:30, I called him. He says, "Are you drinking?" I says, "No, sir." He said, "Don't you take a drink of alcohol today and call me at 3:30 this afternoon." Boom, and he hung up again. Started that walking and shaking, and finally at 3:30 I called him, and he says, "Are you drinking alcohol?" I says, "No, sir." He said, "Do you really want to come to AA?" I said, "More than anything else in this world." He said, "Do you want me to come get you?" And being about as humble as Hitler, I said, "I'll get there under my own steam." And he told me where to go. And he hung up. Well, I was in a terrible predicament. All of my possessions and my clothes I had on. And I heard my wife had thrown out all my clothes. And all I had was a pair of thermal underwear. I had on a pair of old gray flannel pair of flannel pants with all my possessions in my pocket.
an old gray sweater with the elbows out of the elbows, no socks, but I still hadn't quite lost everything yet. I had a pair of beat up old alligator shoes, and I had 30 cents. And that's all left of the money I'd sold, last blood I'd sold to the blood bank to buy wine. And when one comes AA in that shape, one is not doing well. So I looked in the mirror and I looked at myself. I said, I can't go to Alcoholics Anonymous looking like that. I'm a professional man. So I took a chance and called up my wife. I said, Grace, she said, who is this? I said, me. She said, what does me want? I said, Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits? She said, yes, I have one, and it's to bury you in. That's before she come to Al-Anon. I then asked that woman the most foolish question I've ever asked her in my life. I said, do you mind if I borrow it for a little while? I'm going to an AA meeting. It says, another one of your lies. Well, she let me in her house. He's paying the bills and everything else. And now there wasn't instant joy when I went in there to put that suit on. And I told him I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I walked by, everything I touched, everything I looked at, everything I breathed on, she ran behind me and she sprayed. And I put that suit on. I bid she and the young'un goodbye. Got into a Mustang that the bank was looking to repossess it. Couldn't recognize it, looked like an accordion. And off I went to the meeting. And I walked in, looked like the same people that were there 17 years earlier when they threw me out of that group. I walked in and one of them older members walked up to me. He bent over, grinned, he looked at me, and he said, we knew you'd be back. And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life, and I've been fortunate enough to meet with our co-founder, Bill, on one-on-one on quite a few occasions. And hey, we don't have any speakers. Nah, we're just a bunch of talkers, because ours is the language of the heart, and thank God it is not the language of the gutter. And if your group hadn't given you this talk, you've been cheated. That fine member then said to me, he stuck his hand out. His was dry, mine was wet, mine slipped away, and I had to grab it again. He then said to me, welcome, come in, sit down and have a cup of coffee, and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. That is the greatest AA talk I have ever heard in my life. He didn't say to me, you never should have done those things. He didn't say to me, if you really loved me, you wouldn't have done those things. Yeah. And it started a way of life that's indescribably wonderful. Oh, we could have run the steps and the traditions, and we could have even gotten the 12 concepts of world service. But no, the story is still the most powerful element in recovery. And it's our responsibility to see that it has stayed this way. I'd like to talk with you how it is today. When I got to you people, did I realize that my wife and our two sons would ever be under one roof again? Because that marriage had been written off by everything and everybody, and it had no right to be. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon and Grace's life, that beautiful and wonderful lady, this past June the 10th, which was also AA's birthday, Grace and I celebrated our 52nd year of marriage, and that's pretty good for a drunk. Although I wasn't there for many, many years. Now, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you, because I'm in AA and Grace is in Al-Anon, that our marriage is just absolutely perfect, that the butterflies are tranquil, that the bluebirds are hugging and kissing and cooing. Heck no. We have a few short rounds every now and then. We have a few long rounds every now and then. That's what you call clearing the air, communicating. And the best way I can describe our marriage today, it's built on solid, constructive imperfection. Because it's by our imperfections that we grow. And I go to, I don't know, 5, 6 AA meetings a week. Grace goes to 4, 5 Al-Anon meetings a week. We don't see each other enough to have all that nitpicking, arguing, fighting, fussing. Crash been going down now over 28 years, you know? Yeah. And very active. Now, but you see, alcohol didn't save my marriage. No. No. It gave me some principles to live by. To be the kind of a son I've always wanted to be. The kind of a husband I've always wanted to be. And the kind of father I've always wanted to be. And I'm so grateful, thankful that she stayed. Our two sons, they're tremendously successful today. And I didn't have a thing to do with it. Not one thing. The oldest son, when he was 15 years of age, he had a butcher knife for my breastbone. And he's going to kill me for what I was doing to their mother. And if I could have gotten up out of that chair, I'd have beat that boy to death. But then he dropped that butcher knife, and the wildness left his eyes. And he spat in my face. And he says, "You're no longer my father, and I'm no longer your son." And he walked out of my life, and that hurts. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon in the family life. Today, we not only have a tremendously wonderful father and son relationship, but more important, not only with him, son too, but we're the best of friends. You see, their mother was their mother. Their mother was their father. Their mother was their Santa Claus. Their mother took them to picnics. Their mother took them to Cub Scouts and then later on Scouts. Their mother took them on vacations. Their mother was the only link to sanity those two boys had. And they were willing to kill me because they couldn't stand to see what was happening to that link of sanity in this God's world. Yeah. And you know, those were the amends. Those are living amends. You can't just say, "I'm sorry," et cetera, et cetera. And not only with two beautiful daughter-in-laws, but two of the most beautiful granddaughters that anyone could ever want, and I darn near missed the deal. And not long ago, about a few months ago, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, been sober almost 50 years, who knows me, knows the family, knows the situation that I had with that oldest son. He ran into him and said, "How are you and your brother getting along with your father?" And our oldest son, tremendous. We love him. And the member says, "Well, what happened?" He says, "It's real simple. We love him because he treats our mother so good." And I'm going to tell you, don't let that moment go by in life. Hold on to it and grab it. This program, there is no situation too difficult and no unhappiness trait that cannot be overcome. When I got sober, I had to go to the regulatory agencies to regulate my license to practice a profession. And I had to go tell them the truth. They already knew it. They wanted to hear it from me. And they kept me down there for a week, and they said, "We're going to go and let you go back to work." And I've been back. And y'all have heard only those nicer parts of my story. And I'm asked by a lot of members of AA and those who are not in AA. They said, "How did you ever get through school? You've been locked up. You've been gone. How'd you do it?" Well, I was my class valedictorian in high school. I finished second of a class of 450 at Southern Methodist University. And I'm a graduate of Baylor University College of Dentistry. And they all said, "How did you do it?" "It's real simple. You cheat." It doesn't take our kind long to find another human being who will do for us what we cannot possibly do for ourselves. And y'all have been so great, and I'm going to leave you with something. I'm hoping that our General Service Conference, one of these days, will take a portion of a letter, turn it into a service piece, and give it to every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that's a current member and all to come. And it's a portion of a letter that was written to our co-founder Bill on December the 30th of 1946. And the letter was written to Bill by a non-alcoholic. Perhaps a non-alcoholic whose family name is perhaps the most famous family name that the world has ever known. In the areas of money, banking, research, foundations, energy, grants, scholarship. A non-alcoholic, if it hadn't been for this particular non-alcoholic and his non-alcoholic friends, Bill and Bob never would have gone on. We wouldn't have had our 12 steps, which Al-Anon asked that if they could have them. It wouldn't be Al-Anon today. There wouldn't be Al-Ateen. Although we cooperate, we don't affiliate. And that's the strength of the cooperation, to where we are particular and who we carry our message to. That's what's so important. And the letter was written to Bill by John D. Rockefeller, Jr., thanking him for a World War II printing of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, to where they had to cut the size of the paper down due to the paper shortage. Never dropped anything out. The first part of the letter is thanking Bill for the book and the inscription on the flyleaf, but this is the part of the letter I want to leave with you, quote to Bill. It must be of great satisfaction for you to realize that the helping hand that you extended to a needy brother many years ago has resulted in the widespread extension of that brotherly act. The regenerating power of the spirit of that brotherly act and friendly hand has been the means by which countless lives have been saved that otherwise would have been wrecked. May God continue to bless you and use you ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. Every one of us in this meeting, right this very second, all over the world. Everyone in Al-Anon all over the world. Everyone in Al-Ateen all over the world. Everyone who has been a recipient of the principles of our program. Started with the friendly hand of Bill to Dr. Bob, and here we are. They regenerating the power of the spirit to live in this world of reality. Who knows health better than anyone who has been so sick? Who knows freedom better than the one that's been locked up with bondage of self and alcohol? Who knows faith better than one who has denied faith and turned their back on faith and went out of the world and couldn't face life, and after reassessing life, now armed with faith, can face life? Who knows temporal time better than one who stood on the edge of time, hoping that time would obliterate us entirely? We're here as a result of that extension of that friendly hand from Bill to Dr. Bob to Bill D. If there is a hope, if there is a prayer, if there is a desire they have for each and every one of us, may we continue to let God bless us and use us ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in rebuilding a broken life. And how will God continue to do this? And that is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. God bless each and every one. Thank you, and I love you so much.